Welcome to the JPP, the Jewish Philanthropy Podcast. JPP with David M. Cohen, rabbi, lawyer, fundraiser, therapist, and author. Money makes the world go round. It makes different people do different things. In this podcast, we explore views of money and how money is used to impact lives around the world. Each week, we'll engage with another interesting personality in the fascinating and diverse world of Jewish philanthropy. Let's begin now.
I'd like to welcome to the JPP, the Jewish Philanthropy Podcast, my dear chaver, Rabbi Josh Blass. And I'm very excited about this episode because we talk about philanthropy often, but I think the greatest expression of philanthropy is giving of oneself, not only giving of one's resources, but really giving of their time and their energies and really of themselves. And I think this episode will certainly illustrate that point. Rabbi Josh Blass is a Mashkiach Ruchani at Ritz in Yeshiva University, where he has been serving for the last 16 years, if not more. He also served as the rabbi of Kehilas Beis Yehuda in Muncie for 15 years. Rabbi Blass received his smicha from Ritz. He has all different types of advanced degrees. He's going for a master's in social work at present. He has served also as the Rav of the Albert Einstein School of Medicine for 4 years before he came to Muncie. And Rabbi Blass has really been involved in an advisory or leadership capacity with a number of organizations, including Tomchei Shabbos, Project Tikva, the Chevra Kadisha, the RCA based in, and others. He's very involved in the world of Shiduchim and guiding students at YU on issues of dating and as a chassan teacher. And he really is a very, very warm and compassionate chaver, a friend, somebody who I deeply rely on and take counsel with. And it's a kavod gadol to have my chaver, Rabbi Yehoshua, Rabbi Josh Blass, here with us to talk in particular about a very special trip that he recently took.
Thank you, Rabbi Cohen. What an honor it is to join you, and what an honor it is really just to be connected with you for so many decades now, rooming together, learning together, growing together, being at each other's simchas, watching both from close and far, your career and your impact in so many different ways, your tremendous advice as well. So it's a real honor to spend a few minutes together.
Thank you so much. I'm genuinely flattered and touched by that. So I always ask my guests to begin with, after I read off their impressive resumes, I often ask them to tell our audience a little bit in their own words, how they perceive themselves, who they are.
Well, thank you, Rabbi Cohen. Well, it's hard to be able to say who a person is because it's already, you know, assuming a lot. To say that I am X, Y, and Z, and this is who I am. Could be some elements of either gaiva involved, some sense of a feeling of superiority. I would like to think that on my best days and in my best moments, what I aspire to be is a person who is deeply passionate, passionate about a relationship with God, passionate about making a difference in the world, passionate about people, passionate about my family, of course, passionate about Klal Yisrael, and sort of bringing all those things together in a very meaningful way, sort of love of God, love of people, love of chesed, love of growth, of humor, of existence in some way, and to live that fully, and to be able to express that fully, and to be able to sort of live that life of aliveness and energy, in Chesed, in Torah, in the Jewish people. So I think that's the way I would describe myself in my best days. Someone that can be a genuine, passionate, loving person in many, many different spaces with many different types of people, and to try to live that fully. And in a way, that's sort of very simple. You know, forget about a resume. Just living life as a simple, passionate, kind person, without any fanfare and without any maybe recognition for that even, but to sort of occupy that sort of simple space of passion and love.
Thank you for sharing that. I actually have an acquaintance. His name is Jesse Itzler, fascinating fella. He's actually a part owner of the Atlanta Hawks basketball team. Unfortunately, he's sitting shiva this week on the loss of his father. He actually built a course that I actually partook in a number of years ago. It's called Build Your Life Resume. And he's a very big advocate of not classical resumes in the sense of like reading off, you know, I did this, I did that, I went here, but very much in line with what you're expressing, which is life experiences. And a resume is how we live our life, right? It's how we interact. It's how passionate we are. It's the ability to give, to make a difference, to feel good about ourselves and seeing how we interplay with others. So I appreciate that, you know, very deeply in terms of that description. I'm curious a little bit. I mean, I know a little bit because we've been friends for so long and we were roommates, of course, but I'd love for our audience to learn a little bit more about your upbringing and a little bit about your earlier influences and how that kind of shaped and formed the amazing person that you are today.
Thank you. I was just thinking what you said before. I heard a great either podcast or a TED talk from David Brooks many years ago. I'm sure something you're familiar with, about the distinction between resume decisions and eulogy decisions. You know, what you put down on a resume versus sort of how you want to be remembered. And what people, not that we're always thinking about our eulogies, but how you want to, like,
you just eulogize yourself more than you resume yourself.
Oh, no. I think you've now brought upon me a potential early. And you sort of like think about life in those terms. It's not so much like the resume, but it's like the legacy and what you leave in this world and try to sort of live based on that. And so, you know, as far as my upbringing, I grew up in Baltimore. I came to Baltimore because my father, both my parents are still living, special people in their own right. So my father, Dr. Elie Blass, was a psychologist, and he was running a lab for graduate students at Johns Hopkins. And my mother was the vice president of the Jewish Federation in Baltimore. And you wouldn't call my parents, I guess, the most religious people. The feeling in the house was not one of pressure about Jewish law, the pressure about classic Jewish learning. There wasn't, you know, I don't know if we even owned like a Shulchan Aruch or a Mishnah Brura or some classic Sfarim, but it was like a house of tremendous values. Maybe just to give you a few examples of that. First of all, besides my parents' professions, a psychologist, and my father was in psychology of a real sense, like doing good in the world, you know, learning about human beings and how to improve their lives. My mother, the head of the Jewish Federation, a deep feeling commitment to the Jewish community. And there are certain values in our life. I'll tell you like a small snippet. Growing up in Baltimore, so there's like a mix of different people, of different backgrounds. The school my brother went to was a more quote unquote yeshivish school where certain types of descriptions or way people spoke. And my father was once driving carpool and a kid in the carpool referred to an African-American in a sort of Yiddish German type of expression, which I imagine most people know what I'm referring to. And my father pulled the car over and he told the kid, he said, you ever speak that way again, you're walking to school in my car, right? Because that term is a derogatory term, right? It was just unacceptable in my house that people would be spoken about in a derogatory way. You know, African-Americans, non-Jews, you never call a non-Jew by I don't like even saying the word, but you would never say the word like goyim in our house. It was just unacceptable. You know, there's a sense of basic respect for all humanity. There was a real culture of knowledge seeking. Everybody in our house read because we lived in Baltimore. We were only an hour away from Washington. So we went to Washington all the time, to the museums. Our parents were members of the symphony and of the opera. I mean, not opera, but of all. It's like a very cultured, very sort of refined, values-driven type of background. And that really shaped me, even as I maybe became more classically religious, so to speak. I spent years in the Beis Medrash, but the ethics and values of a certain love of humanity, working towards humanity, education, open-mindedness, knowledge seekers, that all very, very much stayed with me, with my brother. I only have one sibling who's older, who's also a musmach. He also got smicha, and he's also a psychiatrist living in Israel. And part of that also, not to speak for too long, but my mother's grandparents played a very big role in our life. They both left Poland in the late 1930s. And so much of our life was about sort of that experience, the immigrant experience, a certain connection back to Europe, certain values that came from Europe, a certain sense of being part of the Jewish community and Jewish history in a very beautiful way, sacrifices you make for your family, dreams of going to Israel that were never met because of, you know, the war. You know, that idea, sort of being grandchildren of immigrants, and specifically my grandparents of who they were, that just like had a huge shaping identity in our life as well. So those were like the major things, parents and grandparents. And also like all the great things in Baltimore, you know, NCSY played a huge role in our life. Our shul, Shom Yamuna, where all different types of people were part of one shul. Everybody knew each other. Everybody knew each other's names. It was sort of a feeling of being raised by many dozens of people, probably very similar to your upbringing with Hempstead, where everybody sort of felt connected to each other. It was like a very, very special upbringing. You know, so grandparents, NCSY, shul, family, values, being out of town, that all played a big role of who I am today.
When I unfortunately didn't know you in high school, but if I would have met you in high school and asked you, you know, Josh, what are you thinking of doing professionally when you get older? What would that answer have been?
Well, I think I'm very lucky because from a very early sense, I developed a sense of myself that I wanted to, in some way, be like a giver. You know, I knew that that's what made me happy. And I wasn't a very religious kid. I was into all the things teenagers are into. I drank too much, and I don't know if I'm allowed to say that in front of, you know, and, you know, hung out with.
It's your show. You could say whatever you want.
Yeah, okay, you know, the typical adolescent thing. You look at me and you say, oh, there's a kid who's trying to be a cool guy, whether or not I was cool or not, but trying to be that. But there was always a feeling of just wanting to do things for people. And so at first I thought that maybe I'd be like a lawyer, like in a Clarence Darrow type of mode, like defending the little person. I was always very concerned about people who are impoverished, always concerned about people who are disabled. So like I knew I wanted to do something like that. Mm-hmm. And then just as time moved on, that sort of morphed into, you know, the rabbinate, teaching, psychology. But that feeling of like that this was a real passion almost from birth, being somehow involved in people's lives. I knew that from 7, 8, 9 years old. And then it's sort of a matter of figuring out like what direction that would take.
Right. Filling it in, kind of shaping it. But yeah, I hear that very, very clearly. Other than, of course, your parents and your grandparents and your brother, who are some of the people or what are some of the ideas that really inspire or inform the life that you have lived, that you have formed?
Well, I think that's a great question. And I think inspiration comes from so many different places in our life, you know, even a connection to nature, you know, and springtime and the change of weather and the beautiful world around us. And just if you're, I guess, a person, which we all aspire to be, of just sensitivity, like you're always just like learning and inspired by everything around us. And I definitely feel that it's like constant inspiration coming from human kindness and human dignity and generosity, and like you feel like you're constantly being inspired. I think I would say specifically for myself, I would break that down into three like very quick categories. Mm-hmm. The first is the opportunity the last 18 years to be a mashgiach ruchani in YU and being surrounded by hundreds of students who I feel close with, who are just yearning, you know, yearning and often struggling and dealing with their own humanity and dealing with their own issues, but just want to be good and want to do good in the world at age 20 and want to be close to God. And like, I'm just like surrounded by that day in and day out in that environment of the yeshiva and students and past congregants of people who are fundamentally just like yearning. And that's the space that they occupy around me, you know, a congregant in a synagogue. I don't know what he's doing on his free time. When he comes to speak to me, he's looking for some way of growing. He's looking for some way of yearning. And to have spent in the rabbinate 19 years, the YU 18 years, be surrounded by that, it's totally transformed my life personally.
Now that's, I mean, it's admirable in the sense that I think your values are also reflected in the spheres where you spend your time.
Right.
You are very much entrenched in environs of people that are seeking, that people are asking, people that want to be better. And right. It's hard not to be impacted by that.
Absolutely. And I would say specifically, a lot of my Rebbeim, people are not really alive. I'm certainly Rabbi Rosenzweig and YU and Rabbi Neuberger, but I think maybe more than anybody, Rav Kook and Rav Tzadok HaKohen and Shlomo Volbe, I think Rav Kook especially, the words aren't just on the page. You feel sort of like the soul of that person a little bit and their aspirations and their feelings about the Jewish people. And that's like very, very precious to me personally. And I would say lastly is maybe what's inspiring is a little bit is maybe like your own sense of your own self. And I don't mean this in any self-aggrandizing way, but maybe a feeling of, God created you, brought into this world, gave you a soul, and, a sense of that a little bit. That sort of is like a light that directs you throughout life, a sense of being brought into this world for a reason and with a soul. And that's something which is sort of very close to my consciousness.
Beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. I'm going to pivot now, if it's okay. I'm going to come back towards the end to some more personal questions, but I think it's such a beautiful segue in terms of working with students, which you've really devoted and dedicated your life to. You've had an experience over the last week. You just came back on Sunday. So basically, the previous week, the week over Purim, you had a very, very unique experience. I'm going to just introduce it very briefly from my vantage point, and then we're going to open up and really explore and discuss, because I think it's really Omed al HaPerek in terms of the Russian-Ukrainian tragic war that is devastating and playing out, before our eyes in the media. And it's very difficult for, thousands, I don't know the numbers, maybe millions, crazy amounts of refugees that have to leave, their homes. Our brethren, Jews, and of course, wonderful people from other nations as well. And as a member of the faculty at Yeshiva University, so you, along with Dr. Erica Brown, who is the recent founder and director of the new Sachs-Herenstein program at Yeshiva, coupled with President Rabbi Dr. Ari Berman, spent a week in Vienna, which is actually my wife's hometown. And you actually interacted with my aunt and my father-in-law briefly, Shul on Shabbos, the Stadt Temple in Vienna. So I think it's really a wonderful opportunity. I know, because we spoke obviously privately, what a transformative experience it was for the students and even for yourself. I'd love to hear a little bit about kind of what you saw, what you experienced, what you can share with us who are kind of at a distance, who kind of are watching, want to help, want to do, but kind of maybe a little bit at a loss besides maybe sending some money, at a click of a button. So please share a little bit about how it came about, what the backdrop was, and what you were able to accomplish in your life.
Thank you, Cohen. This is a topic that is so close and passionate to my heart, just in general, and also just having returned just a few days ago. When we saw the war break out, and it's not even a war; it's a country attacking another country. Without any concern for human life and human dignity. And we saw that at this point, I believe it's 2 million refugees who have left Ukraine, mostly to Poland and to some of the neighboring countries. My feeling was like we just had to do something. I'm not even sure what that would be like. What does it mean to do something? We're not going to run to the Ukraine and start, waving a YU banner, but to talk your whole life about chesed and being there and just people by the hundreds of thousands are streaming into countries and just to sort of stand back and say tehillim, it just felt like we need to do something. Where are these refugees going and who's helping out and where is the money coming from and where are they sleeping and who's taking care of basic things? So I wrote a letter to Rabbi Berman and to some other people in YU saying like, this is like a moment of just the chinuch of what we teach our students. And because I'm only the Mashkiach Ruchani, and those letters don't get looked at. But as you said, my colleague, Professor Dr. Erica Brown, who's the head of the Sachs-Herenstein Center, she also had the same suggestion. And basically within a day, the trip came together. Within a couple days, but my involvement was basically only a day. We had connections of people in Vienna. The arrangements were made. We put out an email late Tuesday night, 2 weeks ago, a little more than 2 weeks ago, to students who was interested in coming. By the next day, we had 125 students who wanted to come. And then a few days later, we left. And it was just sort of just like that. You know, the whole troop had this very sort of, you know, spur of the moment. We really weren't sure what we were doing and where we were going. And, you know.
I don't know if it's Lahavdil Mine, but it's bringing back as you're describing it. So in 1988, when I was in 11th grade at Hafter High School, so we were selected, a few of us, three young men and three young women were selected with a male teacher and a female teacher to go on a mission to the former Soviet Union to lend support to Jews, you know, behind the Iron Curtain. But in contrast, we prepared for 6 months for that mission and for that trip. We missed a lot of class time, which was fun. And the whole experience was, and we were also there Purim time, interestingly enough. But fast forward, obviously now, 30 plus years, this kind of came, obviously this whole experience is maybe a month long now, if that. And obviously you had to put this together, you know, very, very quickly. So you arrive in Vienna. Obviously, I don't know how clear you were on what the expectations were going to be or where to go. So where'd you go? What happened? Like, you got there, like, what happened?
Right, well, that's a great question. We weren't totally sure. They weren't totally sure. We basically got settled. This is going back, you know, Monday, like a week and a half ago. And then we just started working with refugees. The Viennese community were amazing.
So the Kultusgemeinde, right, is like the main communal organization.
Exactly. And they, because they're so organized, they said, we want to take any refugee, but especially Jewish refugees coming from the Ukraine. They were feeding them. They put them in hotels. The kids are now going to school, right? Most, as you probably know, most of the refugees are women and children because the men have to fight. So in the course of
how did these refugees get to Vienna? I mean, just how did people get there?
I can't begin to tell you how just taking people 5-6 days to make a trip of, you know, 180, 200 miles, people standing at the border. There's a lot of wealthy people in Vienna and a lot of people in Vienna who have connections back to Ukraine. And they were able to sort of work out, you know, make connections through the people in Kiev and other cities. Wow. And sort of through almost like backdoor channels, whether it's buses, trains, people driving, they were able to sort of identify the refugees, let them know where to go, let them know, you know, what to do once they got into Vienna, work out with the at border crossings, make sure there's places in school, make sure that there's food. It was an incredible operation. And it was an operation that was done basically by saying, okay, we're going to do it. There's a need to do it. And we're worried how we're going to pay for it afterwards. So it's costing the community $120,000 a week to feed, house, clothe the refugees, teach them. But they said, we have to do it. We have to do it. And we'll find ways of paying for it. And, you know, it's just miraculous and beautiful, sort of that sense of just, you know, rising to the occasion and stepping up to the plate and whatever metaphor you want to use. And then we came in sort of figuring out how to navigate in that sort of space, so to speak. So the first thing we did is we went to one of the hotels actually owned by your wife's aunt or part owned. And we walked in. We had no clue what language to speak to refugees in. We're not sure if they wanted to see us or not see us, whether they're going to be like, who are these bunch of, you know, these do-gooders from America? What are they doing here? But it just worked incredibly, especially with the kids.
How many Jewish refugees would you say are in Vienna right now?
Now, there's about 1,000 Jewish refugees.
1,000.
Okay. And more coming every day. While we were there, hundreds of more came. The kids actually went to one of the hotels, the Orangerie, whatever the hotel is called, to welcome in new refugees. And in a way, it sort of made it much more manageable. Because if you go to, let's say, a city in Poland, you might have 200,000 refugees. They don't want volunteers. They're just totally overwhelmed. By having like 1,000, it gave us a capacity to get to know them and they to know us. And it was like a much more sort of manageable type of situation, both for the community and for us who are coming to volunteer.
Just out of curiosity as well, like, some of these refugees, really not relevant, but just curious, like, are some of these people like observant of Torah mitzvahs? Like,
well, the refugee community that came to Vienna, most of them seem to be observant.
Really?
Wow. We're very traditional.
Wow.
And yeah, you know, and that's what sort of made it in a way meaningful. Also, there was refugees who were coming who had no clue. They had to leave almost in a moment's time. They threw a few things into a suitcase, you know, small suitcase, right? It is funny. You'd appreciate the fact that I was speaking to refugees. They said, well, we packed a lot of food, right? That's what a Jew always thinks about when they leave anywhere. So they had their food and their kugels, but very little room for clothing, let alone Purim costumes and Megillot and Chumashim and Sidurim. And the YU students brought all that. They brought 40 or 50 duffel bags, just of Purim costumes, of Russian Sidurim, of Kiddush cups, of all those things for the refugees. And it really just, it brought such life and joy at this time of life, and especially tied into Purim and sort of that communal experience. It was just incredible.
You know, I mentioned to you before we went live that I had been listening to our friends and colleagues in Boca Raton, the Behind the Bima podcast, and they had one of the Chabad Rabbanim from Ukraine who they interviewed, and they were kind of accenting or highlighting this dynamic that he had like an hour to decide kind of what he was going to take with him. And then Rabbi Goldberg and Rabbi Brody were asking each other, listeners, like, hey, like, if you had to make that decision, what would you take with you? And like, it's interesting, you're, you know, like, it is something, I'm stopping for a second just to accent and highlight that, like, lo aleinu, we should never be in such a circumstance. But the rabbi actually said, the Chabad rabbi actually said, interestingly enough, that it was very empowering, because it brought him to the realization that on some level, like, there really isn't so much stuff that's so important at the end of the day.
Absolutely.
When it comes down to it, if you have yourself and your wife and your family and your tefillin, your talis, you know, one or two other things, like, you know, obviously there might be things you need for survival, but beyond that, like, you know, like, whatever, it's not, you know, we have a lot of things that are nice, but at the end of the day, like, what, you know, it's something to think about. You can think about it over Shabbos, but it's an interesting, I'm thinking about this a little bit. Again, it's like, you can't compare and contrast tragedies a little bit. I guess what's popping into my head right now is I was recently in Bal Harbour, Florida, and I actually went to the site where that building came down, that terrible tragedy that happened in May. Kind of just saw this empty space in the ground and kind of thought back to like people that flew down to Florida to support family and people that suffered from a tragedy. Is it kind of like that kind of attitude or mentality of like going to a place where people are suffering and you're there to lend a listening ear and lend support, or no, it's a different vibe. Like, I mean, how do you, I'm sure people are very concerned about their husbands, right? Who are still, yeah. Like, what were some of the interactions? What are some of the conversations? What were you hearing?
Most of the interactions that I had and that the students had, it wasn't like coming to a place where a building collapsed and people had just died and people had just lost like a loved one, and which is something that probably you and I are very familiar with as being like shul rabbanim, you know, showing up somewhere where someone had just passed away. And that's sort of like one type of conversation. Right? This felt a little bit more communal. The spaces we interacted with was less sort of like the one-on-one talking through feelings. Mm-hmm. A, because they didn't really, you know us necessarily. B, because of like language barriers.
Yeah, like what language were we speaking in here?
A combination of different languages. A lot of the kids spoke Hebrew. Some people spoke English. A few kids on our program spoke Russian. You know, so you're sort of like managing that to the best of ability. Mm-hmm. But I guess when I think about the trip, I think about just a lot of like a kumzitz in the middle of the dining room with refugees and people coming over to sing and dance together. You know, a Purim party on Wednesday night that was like that, the Purim Suda, going to the hotels to play with the kids. It wasn't as much sort of like sitting down and talking through those experiences, but it was more like, what do we do to sort of create like a joyful, positive, optimistic, redemptive feeling?
Right.
And as a result, sort of there was almost like a joyfulness to the
to the program, you know, as opposed to, if, let's say, you would go to Bell Harbor, where there's like nothing joyful about that. It's just pure pain. You know, this was like, how do you sort of go through this really difficult experience? And now let's sort of come together. It's very heart to heart, shoulder to shoulder, Am Yisrael way. And to sort of try to connect in some type of uplifting type of way. And that sort of had that feel to it.
Fascinating. No, that's a great answer. What was the most surprising aspect of it to you? What was, if there was anything that really surprised you, you didn't expect? How would you maybe articulate that?
Well, I wouldn't say that there was a specific thing that surprised me. I think it was everything we hoped that it would be, but like times 100. You know, we hoped we'd be able to come in and meet the refugee children and that it would go okay. And we thought that we could. What we didn't envision is by the end of the week, every time the YU kids would show up, the refugees were coming over to literally hug the kids, to not let them go when they left. We expected that maybe some refugees would be happy to see us. We didn't expect that we'd walk down the streets and literally speak to refugees day in and day out, that we saved their lives, we elevated their lives, we brought joy to the horrible situation, the tears of people, the hugging, the constant hugging, the constant embracing. Wow. We felt that we were able to go and maybe interact with the Viennese community. What we didn't expect is that on Friday night at the Stutt Temple, what's it called again? You're with your Austrian?
I think it's Stutt Temple.
Yeah. Whatever it is. That we would have a dinner with our group, and also in that same room was a group.
Where, in the Shul Kiddush room there?
The Shul Kiddush room, right?
Where I had my Vart. Okay.
Oh wow.
We actually had our 18th wedding anniversary this week, Baruch Hashem.
Oh wow.
So it brings us back to
So we had a dinner, and in the same dining room there was the kids from the local school. Within a few minutes, there was like a big mosh pit of the YU kids and those kids, and then like singing and dancing. And it comes, it's just the kids interacted, and the kids came over afterwards, were going to YU, and they're asking for brachos, and they were hugging. So it was like, we went there, and the connections with the refugees, the community, the people there, the Balabatim, I think because of the backdrop of the war and why we were there and the appreciation, it just created such like a level of connection and passion and happiness and joyfulness that I don't think I've ever experienced before. And I'm not sure that I ever will be able to in the future.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you had two spiritual highlights, I guess, were Purim and Shabbos. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Purim, but being, you know, 25 hours of Purim, we ended up in the Chabad shul for Purim, which, as you can imagine, was pretty fun. And we went on Wednesday night to a Purim party made by a Russian Jew living in for 600 of his closest friends. It was just, it was like a wild experience. I don't know how else to say it.
Did you have any free time to walk around, take in the city a little bit?
We tried to give that to the kids because they really worked hard. People were always calling, can you send the kids to here, to the train station, because the refugees coming in, to this hotel.
Wow.
But the city's so beautiful. And it's also a nice thing when you run a trip for 21, 22, 23-year-olds. You know, they're not babies. You can tell them, okay, just head back to the hotel, make sure you're back by 1 a.m, text us when you get in. So we tried to give them that sort of that freedom, because they really had earned that, you know, that sort of that responsibility to just sort of like wander the city a little bit and scooter around the city of Vienna late at night on a Saturday night. So I think we really felt that connection with the city as well.
Amazing. You mentioned to me a little bit before we went live also that I think there was some sort of formal ceremony with Rabbi Berman, the president of YU, and members of parliament. You want to maybe share that a little bit?
Sure. Well, the president of parliament now is someone by the name of President Sobotka. President Sobotka is a fascinating person. His grandfather was a Nazi, and he never knew his grandfather. But his father really renounced his own father's Nazi past. And now President Sobotka has really taken it upon himself to be a leading advocate for Jews in Austria, for pro-Israel, fighting anti-Semitism. And we met him on Friday. It was very, very meaningful, just the way that how passionately he spoke about sort of fighting for the Jewish community. And then Rabbi Berman gave him a YU sweatshirt at the end. I've never seen a person put on a YU sweatshirt so quickly. It's never happened before. You know? And he was like strutting around the parliament in his YU sweatshirt.
Unless you're connected to YU basketball team or something.
Yeah. And even then, maybe. But I will tell you, just as like a side note, and I'm sure that when you've been to Austria before, which I'm sure you have many, many times, to walk past the place where Hitler in 1938, you know, outside the library, spoke to a million Austrians and sort of the history of the country, and to sort of come back, you know, to that same place wearing yarmulkes and, you know, women in skirts and the country sort of having almost like a collective tshuva, and bringing Jewish values back to that place. There was something very beautiful of, sort of as Rav Kook said, of Am HaNetzach Lo Mefached Mederech Haruka, the eternal nation is not afraid of the long road. And it felt like that, the long road back to sort of the, you know, that area of the world in a very different type of place. And it was very meaningful.
There's a lot to say at this point. I'll just make a few quick points. I'm not a product of the Holocaust, interestingly enough. Like my maternal grandparents, my grandfather came from Russia and he escaped during the Bolshevik Revolution in the late around 1917, 1918, if I'm not mistaken. My maternal grandmother was born in Israel. My paternal grandfather was born in Poland, and my paternal grandmother was born in the United States of America, interestingly enough. And they all were here in the United States way before World War II, you know, thankfully. So I didn't grow up in a family that was, you know, had that kind of remnants of having gone through the Holocaust. And frankly, it's interesting, you know, one of our, I guess, mutual rabbeim, Rav Moshe Weinberger from Esh Kodesh here in Woodmere, I remember bringing Ruchi, my wife, to meet him before we got engaged. And, you know, he's well known that, his father was a famous survivor on some level. Mauthausen, which not far outside of Vienna, and the Tefillin Mauthausen. And I remember, like, on some level, like, just they couldn't be so well that my wife was from Vienna or grew up in Vienna. And again, not personal, but I also like feel like, you know, had I come from that type of family, I probably would not have been able to marry somebody with that background. It's too complex and too difficult. On the other hand, you know, mentioning this other podcast that I referenced earlier, this rabbi from Ukraine who was being interviewed by the Boker Rabbonim, so he actually shared that the world is changing. And I think this is what you're, you know, pointing out as well with the president of parliament in Vienna. He said, although it's clear that Ukrainians exhibited tremendous anti-Semitism over the years, he said that's not the recent reality at all, and that he and his family felt very welcome in Ukraine. I'm not like up to date on the exact, you know, situation in Vienna today. And I know when my wife and I would often host guests at our Shabbos table, particularly when we lived in the city, we'd always be asked, like, my wife, how many Jews in Vienna? Is there anti-Semitism? Like, I actually remember walking with my father-in-law, the chief rabbi emeritus, now, but then he was the chief rabbi, walking on the streets during Pesach, which is coming up. And he actually got pummeled on the street of Vienna. Somebody came and somebody started, knocked him over and started going, Hail Hitler. I actually saw this with my own eyes, but that was a mikre charig. That was a unique experience. I think, you know, I think like it's, these places are eerie on some level, but yeah, I like the way you expressed it on some level of a little bit the Am HaNetzach, this idea that, you know, at the end of the day, we thankfully are still here and we are an amazing nation, amazing people. And that's being expressed in terms of the, you know, miraculousness and the, we would call the siyata d'shamaya that we experience, and the protection, the unique divine protection of our people. And also in terms of the brotherhood that I think you're sharing in terms of the YU students and the refugees. That's very beautiful. I didn't think of that so much. In a sense, it really was like, on some level, like young, it was like kids on some level interacting with college students. That was a very big piece of this dynamic, and that kind of removes a little bit of the complexity of life and war, and it becomes a lot more just about fun and connection and happiness and joy and giving like a will and a reason to go on and to rebuild.
I just want to mention, if you don't mind, you know, we're so ensconced in the communities we're in, you know, either North Woodmere or the Five Towns or in Muncie. It's hard sometimes in those sort of spaces to always feel that sense of Ahavas Yisrael, because everyone's Jewish. People typically are getting on each other's nerves. There's a lot of politics, you know, there's a lot of like who's doing what and what's happening here and who's building what shul and who's, you know, moving in and who's not moving in. And then I have never experienced such a almost just this simple feeling of Avos Yisrael as being there. You know, you get away from everything a little bit, and you know, you're talking to some Ukrainian Jew, and you're arm in arm with him singing Achenu, and he may not even speak English, and he just came out of Ukraine a few days ago. It was like everything sort of fades away, besides like the soul of the matter. And you can go your entire life surrounded by people. Many of them are your relatives. You don't feel that for 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And almost like in a moment with a kid in that setting, it's so palpable and so powerful. Again, I hope to sort of never like lose that feeling, you know, that sort of that Nishmas Yisrael type of feeling.
Well, what I hear you saying is in a different shape or form is that, and it connects to what we said earlier about what would you take with you if you were put in that terrible circumstance. You know, we live such complex lives, and there's so many layers of, just came off of Purim and the Masecha and mask and hiddenness. Like at the end of the day, when push comes to shove and you remove all that nonsense or distraction, yeah, like at the core, like, the, you know, where so much more binds us than divides us. And a lot of times I think we're confused sometimes in terms of what's priority and what's really important. And it sounds like this trip not only gave for yourself a very mature, sophisticated adult, but even for, you know, forming, maturing young men and women in their early 20s who are really picking their life direction, vision, spouses, kind of just a transformative experience to really take with them about, you know, what really matters in life. And I think you shared with me also kind of offline, maybe you'll share a little bit about kind of just some of the reactions, what you were seeing and hearing from some of the young men and women who like this really kind of reoriented them in terms of where they're going from here.
Yeah. And that's really what it is. And if I can make almost like a plug, not so much for YU, but a plug for what I felt we collectively gained from that experience, where, you know, you might have these like great kids in YU and planning on going, let's say, to law school and becoming a lawyer, working at a big firm, something you know a lot about. And you know, there's nothing wrong with that.
As do you, through your wife.
No, I do as well, absolutely. Adjacent to a very chashuv lawyer at a big law firm, my wife, of course. And not to say there's anything wrong with going to law school or working at a big law firm. By all means, do that. But the question is, are we driven by a feeling of making a difference in the world? You know? Like, what are we doing for the future of the Jewish people, for the future of the world? How are we bringing some sense of comfort or tikkun or chesed? And what's our impact going to be? And because it costs so much money just like to sort of live in this world, so then the average person at 21, 22, 23, their mindset is, okay, what do I have to do in college? What internship do I have to get? How do I get this job? How do I do this? And then do we step back and like ask ourselves those big questions? Like, what do we take with us, so to speak? What's in that small suitcase? You know, what are our values? What's our legacy? What are the eulogy decisions we're making? And what I saw in front of my eyes in 1 week is sort of the reorientation of kids who are great kids. But now all of a sudden they're saying, well, yeah, I want to be in computer science, but I also need to find some way of manifesting something more than that of myself. Kids who were, you know, dating and thinking, well, who am I going to marry that's going to be a partner for me in that mission or in that vision of what I can be in this world, you know? And just like to sort of see almost like the awakening within the students of like those questions, right? Me and the world, you know, and how do I sort of live a life that I can look back on with a great sense of pride in? And it was incredible to watch it.
Well, I think it's an expression, I think, which I mentioned to you at the time when we spoke about it. And this is like a miniature version of kind of a microcosm of whether you want to say it's a year in Eretz Yisrael, whether you want to say it's, I'm thinking back many years, I spent a summer in Perth, Australia. You know, people go on these NCSY summer tours. There are these inflection points that many of our young men and women are privileged to partake in. This is obviously very, very unique experience in a very compact period of time that enable us to kind of really, as we're talking, I'm thinking to myself, it's like almost funny thing to say. I'm sure my mother's going to listen to this too, so I'm going to be careful what I say here. But, you know,
hello, Mrs. Cohen.
I'm thinking that when I was, you know, when I was in my 20s, 21, 22, I went to Israel for 2 years and I became very idealistic, as many of us in our chevra did. And I don't even know how much we thought about, like, you know, the bills and the expenses of life. And I don't think they were, you know, then what they are today. That's the truth. And I think my parents, their credit, were trying to like kind of reorient me and say, you know, like you need to get a law degree. You need to like be aware that, you know, and then as you get older and then, you know, things don't always go exactly the way you hope. But then you start to realize, wait a second, there really are a lot of expenses and priorities and things you do have to deal with in life. There's no question about it. And it's just interesting. There's the constant, I think, in different directions. There's the idealism becoming realism. There's the realism becoming idealism. And I think it's something that we all struggle with throughout our lives, kind of where there's, you know, there is a very strong practical aspect of things that need to be done and bills that need to be paid and yeshiva tuition and so on and so forth. But at the same time, there is, I think, for everybody. And I see this in my philanthropic work. You know, you see even the wealthiest, most successful people in terms of having made money, if you define success in that way very narrowly, still at some level they want to give back, they want to make a difference. Like, it's not a satisfying life just to live life just purely for your senses and for your gratification and not to be able to kind of share that largesse. And like, we all have different ways of sharing, you know. And this is a beautiful expression, you know, I haven't mentioned in a while on this podcast, but Moshe Feinstein, if I'm not mistaken, has a construct that is a concept of miser, of ksafim, of our earnings, but there's also a concept of miser of zman, of kind of delineating time, you know, whether it's learning with somebody who's weaker than you are and helping them in their learning, or being involved in, you know, you told me there were some vibrant discussions with the students, yourself and Dr. Brown on Friday night, in terms of chesed, in terms of how we're able to kind of give to others. So this is a beautiful expression of all the great work that you've been doing at Yeshiva for so many years, and that the broader institution is doing in terms of forging the leaders of the future, right? Which is really, this was a trip for future leaders. So this is really what leadership is about.
If I can actually, if you don't mind, I'm sure up against the clock, but one of the questions you sent me in advance, and one of the things that I feel luckiest about, is the best piece of advice I ever received before, and the worst piece of advice. I'm not sure about the worst piece of advice. Maybe I just sort of blocked that out of my consciousness. And I'm not sure if I would even say this is advice, but it's more just my father's entire way of being for the last 50 years. My father's entire way of being, and what he always communicates with my brother and I, is to do something in the world that is really meaningful to you and be good at it, and you'll make a living doing it. Right? And that was always the first question. The first question is, what are we going to do that we feel is close to our souls, that would make a difference in the world, that we would enjoy? And like, then the money, and if you're good at those things, whether it's as a therapist or as a rabbi or as a teacher, okay, so then like the money's going to sort of come if you're successful in those areas. And something that I speak to our students about at NYU, and something I spoke about Friday in Vienna about, like, you know, and so often the first question people ask themselves is like, okay, well, how do I make a living in the world? I think it's like the wrong question. You know, the first question is, how do I be happy in this world? Let me do that well. And then, you know, as long as I'm being realistic about it, as opposed to being like a professional, you know, flamethrower or whatever. And I feel like that needs to be sort of part of the chinuch of our kids, you know, like those types of questions and self-definition and decisions about career that are based on that.
It's a beautiful.
I feel lucky that I was the recipient of that.
It's beautiful advice. I think it gets harder and harder as life becomes more complicated for people to genuinely stay in touch with that. Yep. But I think at the core, it remains true, no doubt. And thank you for sharing that. As we wind down with one or two final questions, so I always like to just ask my guests in terms of, what are some of your hobbies? What do you do for when you have, I know you don't have so much free time, but when you do have a minute or two to relax, to breathe, what are some things that you enjoy doing?
Well, I guess there's all of this, like the hobbies that I enjoy, which is first and foremost, probably reading. I love the baseball. I love the baseball games with my kids. I love, because we live here in Rockland County and we've been blessed to host you many times.
Yeah.
Going hiking and going fishing. I bought a canoe last summer. Wow. I bought a kayak. And one of my favorite things in the world is going out on an Erev Shabbos after I finish cooking kayaking for a couple hours by myself out in the water, like anything that relates to nature, I absolutely love.
There's this water near your house to just go and
everywhere. Like, you know, we're not like, it's not like living in the five towns, you know, we're here. It's like you drive 20 minutes. But probably my favorite thing besides things with my kids, obviously, is going out with a close friend, either for a cup of coffee or a beer and just sitting. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that. Not alcoholic beer, of course, you know, and just sitting down for a few hours over a beverage and just talking about life with a close friend. Like, that's like the thing that I sort of like yearn for sometimes, like most, because I feel like that just gets me back to myself a little bit. So all the things, you know, reading, nature, hiking, baseball, you know, but sort of friendship over a cup of coffee is probably the thing that I find most pleasure in.
It happens to be that's what I do for, to say this facetiously, like bring it all together. What I do for a living is I have coffee with people. That's really what I do. Not what I do exactly, but it's descriptive of how I spend most of my days.
If you can make a living having coffee with people, so
not bad. Coffee doesn't even be, I think coffee is just a concept. And by the way, in Vienna, I never really became a big coffee drinker until really right before the pandemic, interestingly enough. And it became part of my whole pandemic routine, which I've talked about in other places. But in Vienna, coffee is like a big deal. They have like crush of a coffee in Vienna. Like, let's do coffee. And it's like in Vienna, that means something. Right. Like what was shul like on Shabbos? Was it a complete zoo or no? Like, were the refugees in shul? Like, what was going on?
The refugees were not in shul. We actually davened, I don't want to be pejorative at all, but we davened at the main shul, which is not totally, you know, it's a very, very, very old school, very European, very formal.
It's formal. Let's say it like that. It's formal.
The seats are like straight, like ramrod straight. That's uncomfortable.
But it goes very high up, right?
So it's a beautiful, beautiful shul. But we daven there, and the shul, we daven there because the shul had made a kiddush in our honor, which was very, very lovely.
Oh, wow, nice. Okay.
And the current rabbi actually is a YU musmach, and Rabbi Berman also spoke. So we had it was lovely.
Rabbi Berman gave the drasha and shul on Shabbos?
In English, yes. The rabbi gave it first in German, and then Rabbi Berman spoke in English.
Fascinating. You know, I never got to give a drasha in that shul because I didn't speak the language, interestingly enough. And I would always be very frustrated. My father would give a drasha and like he'd make jokes because he's like a funny guy like that. And like I never understood like half. I think on the way home from shul, they like explained to me like what the Dvar Torah was. I was like clueless, like literally. The first time I was in Vienna for a Seder, which was the first year I got married, this was right after I got married. I got married for Rosh Chodesh Nisan. And a few weeks later, I found myself in Vienna for my first maiden Seder. As a married person, and the Seder was in German, and it was like also like I mean it's a little easier because obviously I know the text of the, but the conversation was difficult to follow.
A little jarring in certain ways to hear like a Seder in German, you know.
The joke is I don't even know if my wife speaks German anymore. I'm saying that facetiously because I know she does, but she really doesn't because she Kimon never uses it anymore.
Right. But Cohen, if you don't mind, you mentioned it's your 18th year anniversary. So actually at Shalosh Shudis, we had a Shalosh Shudis with our group and a group of not religious students, Jewish students who were spending time in Vienna. And everyone was game to tell stories. So I said, I want to tell the story of my close friend, Rabbi Cohn, who married the daughter of the chief rabbi. And I told the whole story of how you and Ruchi met and that famous, famous cab ride up to the grave Shmar Chai. So it's an opportunity to wish you Mazel Tov. And you should have enormous success in the many, many, many decades ahead of all the great things I'm sure you're going to do and have done already.
Amen. Thank you. That's very sweet. And I guess it's really kind of we're in between, right? We're in between our English anniversary and our Hebrew anniversary. So it's one elongated celebration. My wife and I still owe each other anniversary cards. We're working on it. We did go out to dinner. So that was
good. Listen, that's more than most people.
That was good. But it's an auspicious time in our lives. I'm sure you're married for, I don't know, probably 28 years, if not more. Just guessing.
26 years.
And I know you just had a very special milestone birthday, and I have the same one coming up in a few months.
Wow.
So it's great times. It's obviously very difficult times at the same time. And my bracha to you as well, Rabbi Blass, is that you should continue to evolve and to grow and to develop. And I think most importantly, to impart this beautiful quality that you possess of attempting to sincerely make a difference and to continue to grow. And you should continue to transmit that to the thousands of students that you have already impacted and continue to impact till 120 years. You know, Rabbi Haskell Lichtenstein, by the way, just celebrated his, if I'm not mistaken, his 90th birthday at KJ just last week or 2 weeks ago. And I think they were joking around, like he was like, you know, it was time to update that expression of till 120, like till more than 120, you know, like Baruch Hashem, people are living long lives. And thank you so much for making the time and sharing this incredible experience. Is there anything, just if people want to help, if people want to do more, do you have any insight? Obviously, I'm aware I work at the Orthodox Union. You can go to the OU website. There's a link there. The funds are definitely being, overseen and being transmitted properly. I know Rabbi Hauer had a meeting with all the five towns Rabbanim just last night to discuss shul campaigns. I'm not in a situation. Like if somebody just wanted to like fly to Vienna right now and like help, like what let's end off with that.
I'm not totally sure. And, it's such a beautiful thing being part of Chai, so everyone wants to help. What people don't want is just people sort of like picking up and flying out. We're here. Like everything needs to be done, in an organized, seichodic way. If not, it becomes too stressful for the organizers of any community to have to worry about people just sort of jumping into the fray, which a lot of people want to do. They're like, okay, we're going to go. Well, like you need to sort of work with the people on the ground. I will tell you that we are very close with the people running the community in Austria. If people are interested in helping in some way. I'll also mention that if you go on the YU page, it's, yu.edu, feed refugees. Oh, wow. And that the money goes directly to the Austrian community who are taking in more and more refugees. And I'd also ask, sort of, if you don't mind, I'll give my email address, which is blas@yu.edu.
I don't mind at all. I hope you don't mind.
No, I don't mind at all. I would love if any of your listeners, if I can ever be of any support or students or people whose kids are in YU or people then somewhere looking for more just, connection in their life. But specifically as it relates to this issue with the refugees, please reach out to me. Maybe to discuss ways that you can be helpful. So amazing. That's blass@yu.edu.
Blass, BLASS @yu.edu. Okay, amazing. Yeah. Thank you so much, Roy Blass. Wish you a great Shabbos.
And
thank you so much for being our guest on the JPP.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any feedback or comments, you can reach Rabbi Cohen at info@rabbidavidmcohen.com or on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or Instagram. If you have any suggestions for participants in the program or are interested in sponsorship opportunities, contact us as well.